This episode is brought to you by Terminix. There's one thing we can all agree on. Dealing with pests is a pain. But luckily, Terminix can help. Because when pests show up, so does Terminix. With over 95 years of experience, they have what it takes to take on any pest problem fast. So if your home or business has pests, don't stress it. Terminix it. Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today. That's TERMINIX.com.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
If you're interested in crazy stories from the wild world of organized crime, scams, gangs, cartels, mafias, drug dealers, and everything fun like that, have we got a podcast for you. The Underworld Podcast is hosted by two conflict journalists, Danny Gold and Sean Williams, who have reported on all sorts of dangerous people in dangerous places. Every week, they bring you a new episode on international organized crime from a new corner of the globe. You can find the Underworld Podcast on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
What it felt like was just a concussion of some kind, an earthquake. The whole ground shook, and then I seen all kinds of smoke.
Terrorist attacks tend to be the subject of numerous, often conflicting, conspiracies.
The chaos, the violence, the horror. When the dust settles, it's human nature to think that there has to be a deeper reason behind an attack.
Sometimes we're right. A terrorist attack, by definition, is carried out to make a political point.
But how can we know when that attack is the brainchild of one man? Two men, a network of terrorists, or even an entire government?
The 1995 Oklahoma City bombing was the deadliest act of domestic terrorism ever carried out by American citizens on their own country's soil.
For over 20 years, we've known the two men who masterminded the crime, Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. As the official story goes, these two men are the only people responsible for planning and carrying out the attack.
But were there more? Was the attack part of a larger plan?
Is it possible that someone responsible for this bombing is still out there?
Welcome to Conspiracy Theories, the podcast where we dig into the complicated stories behind the world's most controversial events and search for the truth. I'm Carter Roy.
I'm Molly Brandenburg.
And neither of us are conspiracy theorists.
But we are open-minded, skeptical, and curious. Don't get us wrong. Sometimes the official version is the truth.
Ah, but sometimes it's not.
You can listen to previous episodes of Conspiracy Theories, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Many of you have asked how you can help support the show, and if you enjoy the podcast, the best way to do that is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening.
This week is our final episode on the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. We'll be discussing the main conspiracy theories surrounding the attack.
The first conspiracy theory holds that Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols were being secretly funded by a Middle Eastern terrorist cell with a mission to attack the United States.
The second conspiracy theory is that McVeigh and Nichols were being supported by a larger network of white supremacists.
Finally, the third conspiracy theory deals with what involvement, if any, the United States government might have had in the attack.
Last week, we discussed the known facts of the Oklahoma City bombing, as well as the conspiracies that led Timothy McVeigh to the point of violence.
Before he was a terrorist, Timothy McVeigh was a survivalist, a white supremacist, and an anti-government fanatic.
After voluntarily discharging himself from the armed forces, McVeigh became a radicalized pro-Second Amendment proselytizer. He traveled the country selling guns at gun shows and associating with white supremacist groups.
McVeigh saw the government as a tyrannical regime. He strongly believed that the United States government would one day use force to disarm its citizens as part of a planned subjugation.
To McVeigh, that fear came to pass with the Ruby Ridge standoff in 1992.
The Ruby Ridge standoff was the violent conflict between the Weaver family and law enforcement that resulted in three deaths.
Randy Weaver, like McVeigh, was a survivalist. He was also the worst kind of person McVeigh could look to as an inspiration.
Weaver attended meetings of the World Aryan Congress, a summit for various groups of white supremacists. He'd been on the government's radar since as early as 1985 due to threats against the government.
In 1992, Weaver and his family were involved in an 11-day standoff after he refused to turn himself in for a weapons charge. The incident resulted in the death of Weaver's son, his wife, and a United States Marshal.
Weaver eventually surrendered and later successfully sued the government for its handling of the incident. The court found that the FBI and Marshal Service had been negligent in their handling of Weaver's arrest, and that led to the standoff and the resulting deaths.
To McVeigh, this was as clear-cut an example of the government waging war against its citizens as he was ever going to get.
Well, he was wrong about that. A year later, in 1993, U.S. law enforcement engaged the Branch Davidians religious cult in a standoff at a ranch in Waco, Texas.
As was the case in the Ruby Ridge standoff, the initial cause of the conflict was illegal weapons possession. The Branch Davidians, under the leadership of David Koresh, attacked the U.S. officers who attempted to raid the compound.
After a standoff that lasted over 50 days, the siege ended when the FBI raided the compound and the Branch Davidians set fire to the ranch, killing over 70 people.
The Waco siege garnered nationwide media coverage as the standoff was going on. McVeigh actually traveled to Waco to show his support for the Branch Davidians. When the siege ended violently, he once again had proof that the government was seeking to take away citizens' rights to possess firearms by deadly force.
Armed with his fear of the government, his military skills, and his network of people who held similar beliefs, McVeigh concocted and carried out a plan to blow up the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City.
Witness Greg Pfaff is a Virginia deli owner who told jurors he met Timothy McVeigh on the gun show circuit and that once McVeigh appeared agitated about the siege at Waco. Later, he said McVeigh called to ask about detcord, something that can be used to set off explosives. He said McVeigh persisted, saying he needed it bad and was willing to drive all the way from Arizona to get it.
His accomplice was Terry Nichols, an ex-soldier like McVeigh who shared his hatred of the government, love of guns, and overtly racist views.
For a time, Nichols and McVeigh lived on a ranch that Nichols owned, acting out paramilitary exercises and planning their attack.
Nichols helped McVeigh design and build the bomb. He even went with McVeigh to Oklahoma City. But for a reason that to this day remains unclear, Nichols did not accompany McVeigh to the Murrah Building on April 19, 1995.
Regardless of this, he was easily implicated in the bombing and is currently serving out a life sentence without possibility of parole.
Two more people were arrested in relation to the bombing, Michael Fortier and his wife, Lori. McVeigh had told Michael about his plan months before the bombing. Michael turned down McVeigh's offer to take part in the plan, but he had told Lori about it, implicating her as well.
They were both charged for failing to alert the government to the plan. Both of the Fortiers testified against McVeigh in exchange for immunity for Lori. Michael served 12 years and was placed in the Witness Protection Program upon his release.
These four were the only people to ever be officially charged with crimes related to the Oklahoma City bombing.
However, there is one mystery about the case that has persisted through the decades. John Doe No. 2.
John Doe number two is a potential third man that helped McVeigh and Nichols carry out the bombing.
In the hours after the explosion, the FBI tracked McVeigh to the rental company where he had acquired the truck he used for the bombing.
The rental workers helped the FBI assemble a sketch of the man that they would quickly confirm as Timothy McVeigh.
However, a number of witnesses at the rental agency and in Oklahoma City reported a second man spotted with McVeigh. This man could not have been Terry Nichols, as Nichols was not in Oklahoma on the day of the bombing.
This man was called John Doe number two. The media coverage of the bombing and its aftermath naturally drew a lot of attention to John Doe number two and the fact that, if he exists, he has not ever been found.
The FBI and the U.S. government stand by their official statement that the case is closed, and the people responsible for the bombing are dead, in prison, or have served their time. The official stance of the U.S. government is that John Doe number two does not exist, and that the conspiracy-prone public simply invented an accomplice that wasn't there. The first conspiracy regarding the Oklahoma City bombing asked the question of whether McVeigh and Nichols were part of a foreign terrorist plot to destabilize America, which culminated in the Murrah Building bombing.
The significance of the John Doe number two mystery in relation to this theory can't be overstated. Regardless of whether there was actually a third man, the fact that he might exist allows for any number of theories about who he is and what his role was. Some people believe this mysterious man was a foreign terrorist agent.
It seems hard to believe today, but prior to the 1995 bombing, a terrorist attack in the United States meant something that might kill or injure a few people.
Before the Oklahoma City bombing, terrorist incidents in the United States consisted almost exclusively of shootings or firebombings in which fewer than five people were killed.
In the early 90s, the most high-profile terror attack in the United States was the World Trade Center truck bombing in 1993.
The attack was masterminded by Ramzi Youssef, a Kuwait-born terrorist who led an al-Qaeda cell in the early 1990s.
On February 26, 1993, Youssef and one of his cohorts detonated a truck bomb in the garage below the World Trade Center's North Tower. Their plan was to cause the North Tower to collapse into the South Tower, bringing both buildings down.
The plan to collapse the buildings was unsuccessful, but six people were killed in the explosion and over 1,000 people were injured.
At the time, it was the largest attack of this kind to occur in America in recent memory.
While the six dead victims of the attack were undeniably a tragedy, it was the scope of the injuries that really drew attention. To put the scope of this attack into perspective, the most notable bombing to occur on American soil prior to the 1993 World Trade Center bombing was the 1975 LaGuardia Airport bombing, which killed 11 and wounded 74.
To many Americans, it was the first time they considered that a single attack could harm so many people.
Four of the terrorists involved in the World Trade Center bombing were quickly captured by law enforcement, tried, and imprisoned. But Ramzi Youssef managed to flee the country and evaded capture for nearly 2 years.
Youssef was at large during the period when McVeigh and Nichols were planning to bomb the Murrah Building. This fact is often brought up to support the theory that foreign terrorism was involved. Since his whereabouts were unknown, it's possible that Youssef could have had a hand in planning the attack.
On the morning of April 19, 1995, as word of the explosion in Oklahoma City traveled across the country, it was impossible for most American citizens to not suspect foreign terrorism. Despite the fact that several media outlets noted the significance of the date of the Oklahoma City bombing as the anniversary of the Waco siege's end, a number of outlets, including the New York Times, jumped to the conclusion that Arab terrorists were behind the attack, with no evidence to back up the claim.
Even though the FBI publicly stated within hours that they were looking for a white man who was likely a right-wing extremist, anti-Arab sentiment pervaded the country in the following days.
attacks against innocent Arab Americans increased. Anti-discrimination officials blamed false media coverage for the sudden uptick in violence.
In the immediate aftermath of the bombing, a number of America's allies reached out to offer aid. President Clinton actually declined an offer from the Israeli Prime Minister. Accepting Israel's help before U.S. intelligence could confirm the bombers' identities might lead people to falsely assume the bombing was an act of Muslim extremism.
Additionally, if it turned out the terrorists were in fact Middle Eastern, accepting help from Israel might promote further anti-Arab hate crimes.
Thus far, this conspiracy seems to only be rooted in the knee-jerk reaction to the bombing that led people to suspect Middle Eastern terrorists of being involved. Where's the proof?
It starts with a number of similarities between the Murrah Building bombing and the World Trade Center bombing. Both attacks were bombings of federal buildings. Both were supposed to detonate bombs in the garages of their target buildings, though in McVeigh's case, he was not able to actually fit his truck into the garage and had to set the bomb off in front of the building.
The key link between the two attacks is that Timothy McVeigh and Ramzi Youssef both used Ryder rental trucks for their attacks. And in both cases, it was a recovered axle with a readable vehicle identification number that allowed law enforcement to trace the bombing to the perpetrators.
In addition, the trigger mechanism used in both attacks to set off a time-delayed explosion bore similarities. And both bombs were homemade, chemical explosives that used ammonium as a primary component. The similarities between the two bombings could imply that the two bombs were being made from the same handbook.
But that evidence is only circumstantial. There was and is still no concrete proof that McVeigh or Nichols ever knowingly associated with Al-Qaeda terrorists.
Well, let's keep digging. Perhaps the most substantial fact we have to support this first theory is the bizarre travel habits of Terry Nichols.
We'll look into Nichols' travel records after this quick break.
This episode is brought to you by Terminix. Terminix can't help you solve the world's biggest mysteries or take on alien life, at least not the ones you're thinking of, but they can help take care of pesky invaders in your home, like the ants in your kitchen, the roaches under your sink, and the termites in the walls. Because when pests show up, so does Terminix. No matter what type of bug it is, they can Terminix it fast with personalized pest care that puts you in control. And with over 95 years of experience, it's no wonder they're trusted by homes and businesses everywhere. So if you have a pest problem, don't stress it. Terminix it. Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today. That's TERMINIX.com.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
And now back to the story.
We discussed in the last episode how Terry Nichols' second wife, Marie Faye Torres, emigrated from the Philippines to marry Nichols as a part of a mail-order bride service. Nichols and Marie Faye had met during his first trip to the country through a service that claimed to offer mail-order brides as a likely front for a prostitution ring. Torres soon joined Nichols in America. Between 1990 and 1995, Nichols made a number of trips to the Philippines, sometimes without his wife.
He traveled alone to the Philippines even though his wife was from there? That's a little strange.
On one such trip, his tour guide, Daisy Gillespie, claims he was inquiring about contacts in the Filipino military who might help train him in bomb making.
Terry Nichols' final trip to the Philippines was in late 1994, not long before the bombing in April 1995. Before he departed, he left an envelope for his first wife, Lana Walsh, with instructions to only open it if he didn't return.
She opened it immediately. The note inside contained instructions for how to find $20,000 that Nichols had hidden away for Lana and her and Nichols' son.
Terry Nichols was habitually unemployed. He was unable to hold a job due to a general lack of any particular skill set. Where on earth did he get $20,000 that he could just hide away?
When asked about it during his trial, Nichols claimed that the $20,000 had come from babysitting.
Nichols was a survivalist, and it's possible that he'd managed to scrounge together some money to hide away in the event of a catastrophe. However, the timing of Nichols' visits to the Philippines suggests another source of the money.
It has been confirmed that Ramzi Youssef was in Manila during at least one of Nichols' solo trips to the Philippines. Now, investigators have looked into whether the two men might have ever met. They found no substantial evidence.
But the possibility exists. These are two men, one terrorist and one terrorist in the making, both of whom see themselves as freedom fighters. They are in the same country at the same time, while Nichols is reportedly asking around for someone to help him make a bomb. And when Nichols later assists in the making of that bomb, it bears a striking resemblance to the same device Youssef used for the World Trade Center bombing.
When Nichols learned that Lana Walsh had opened his note, he made a series of calls from a boarding house in Cebu City in the Philippines. We don't know who he was calling.
This also coincides with the period during which Nichols began to become hesitant about actually carrying out the bombing. He wrote a note to McVeigh from the Philippines that read, "You're on your own. Go for it."
Likely another letter meant to be opened in the event of Nichols' disappearance or death.
But why was Nichols worried he wouldn't return from the Philippines at all?
One possibility comes from the testimony of Michael Fortier. Fortier had been with McVeigh and Nichols during their time in Arizona when they were continuing with their self-run paramilitary training. According to Fortier, McVeigh and Nichols weren't very good at building a bomb. They had failed a number of tests and generally showed little aptitude for bomb making. That is, until Terry Nichols returned from his final trip to the Philippines and was able to work with McVeigh to build a device that would kill 168 people.
So, in the course of one brief jaunt to the Philippines, he went from being as unskilled at bomb making as he was at just about everything else in his life to creating a bomb that was used in the deadliest attack of domestic terrorism in U.S. history?
According to Michael Fortier, he did. And Fortier was one of the few witnesses who could have testified to McVeigh's and Nichols' mindset during the months before they set off the bomb.
Terry Nichols goes to the Philippines a number of times. After a few of these trips, he's able to show McVeigh how to build a working bomb when before they were getting nowhere. On the last known trip, Nichols behaves like a man fearing for his life and reveals he has a hidden stash of $20,000.
The implication here would seem to be that Nichols got the help he needed from Al-Qaeda operatives.
On that final trip, he may have suspected that his new friend saw him as a loose end and might find a way to get rid of him.
Or just as likely, he thought that the U.S. government might be tracking him.
If he really was meeting with Al-Qaeda terrorists, he could have stepped into FBI or CIA surveillance, a level of scrutiny he and McVeigh wouldn't have garnered on their own. It's possible Nichols refused to go through with the bombing because he was afraid the government was already on his tail.
But of course, this is still all just implication and conspiracy.
No Al-Qaeda operative has ever expressed even knowing of Timothy McVeigh or Terry Nichols before the bombing.
And given that McVeigh was executed by lethal injection in 2001, and Nichols is as quiet as ever, it's likely we'll never know.
John Doe number 2 is another factor that some people look to when trying to find support for this theory.
Unfortunately, it's difficult to determine what the actual facts are and what stems from racial profiling.
As we've said, a number of witnesses state that they saw McVeigh with another man in the days leading up to the bombing. This man was not Terry Nichols.
Quite a few descriptions of the second man indicate that he might have had a darker skin tone. He may have been of Middle Eastern descent.
If he was a foreign national from the Middle East, John Doe number 2 could be the missing link between McVeigh, Nichols, and a larger network of Al-Qaeda terrorists.
But one question remains. Why? Why would McVeigh and Nichols, both proud right-wing extremists, associate with foreign terrorists?
Well, there comes a point where radicalism leads to an utter detachment from reality. Though both McVeigh and Nichols were white supremacists, and McVeigh had actually served in the Gulf War, their anti-government ideals were more or less in line with the ideology employed by Al-Qaeda to justify its attacks. As the saying goes, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
That's a potential reasoning, but I'd say generally, this conspiracy theory seems not up to snuff.
I have to agree. There are some similarities between the World Trade Center bombing and the Oklahoma City bombing. I think that fact has led people to look for a connection between McVeigh, Nichols, and Al-Qaeda where none exists.
The John Doe number 2 connection is particularly flimsy. If Ramzi Youssef actually did meet with Nichols and was savvy enough to prevent that fact from ever being confirmed by U.S. intelligence, why on earth would he send someone who could potentially link the attack back to Al-Qaeda to be there on the day of the bombing?
It's entirely possible that Nichols was looking for help from foreign terrorist cells during his trips to the Philippines, and maybe he even found some. But while Nichols and McVeigh often portrayed themselves as heroes, in reality, they were amateurs. A lot of their actions made no logical sense.
It's more likely that a seasoned terrorist group like Al-Qaeda would stay away from Nichols and McVeigh.
Ramzi Youssef was captured by international law enforcement in 1995. He is currently serving a life sentence in a federal prison. If he had something to do with the Oklahoma City bombing, wouldn't he have let the world know?
I'd give this one a 2 out of 10. It certainly makes sense why this conspiracy exists, and there are even some interesting coincidences that may connect McVeigh and Nichols to a broader foreign terrorist cell. But generally, there's just so much more evidence to show that this attack was domestic in nature.
While McVeigh and Nichols were likely not being supported by foreign terrorists, there is a possibility that they were part of, or at least being supported by, a domestic terrorist organization.
Our second conspiracy theory addresses whether McVeigh and Nichols were part of a larger network of white supremacists who were planning to start a war between the U.S. government and its citizens.
McVeigh and Nichols were white supremacists. When they first met during basic training for the Army, they reportedly bonded over a shared dislike of black people.
During their respective trials, both McVeigh and Nichols would claim that they didn't have much to do with the Aryan Brotherhood and that their actions were firmly motivated by hatred of the government. But it's important to look at how white supremacist ideology and anti-government extremism go hand in hand in this case.
For most of their lives, McVeigh and Nichols had trouble holding steady jobs. They blamed the government. The economic downturn of the 1980s was in part due to United States business increasing its reliance on foreign labor.
Foreign being the ideal word here. To McVeigh and Nichols, the government was taking away potential opportunities in blue-collar jobs and giving them to undeserving non-Americans.
Additionally, affirmative action, a type of policy that encourages employers to hire women and people of color, was becoming more and more a part of the career world in America. To McVeigh and Nichols, who already showed a limited skill set that qualified them for very few jobs, the government was further infringing on their ability to work by prioritizing women and people of color over white men like themselves.
Both men exemplified a dangerous mixture of anger, powerlessness, and an adeptness at managing guns and explosives.
Of the two, Nichols seemed to be more passively racist than McVeigh. McVeigh showed a pattern of racist thoughts, words, and actions over his entire life.
While he was a sergeant in the Army, McVeigh reportedly singled out non-white soldiers for the worst or hardest jobs.
Later, as he was making a living touring gun shows and selling weapons, McVeigh would fall in with like-minded white supremacist people with an extra passion for the Second Amendment.
Some of them might have even had a part to play in the bombing. But before we get into that, we need to look at what some conspiracy theorists consider to be a major inconsistency in the official explanation for the Murrah building bombing.
There has long been suspicion about McVeigh's bomb and whether it alone was powerful enough to cause the damage it did.
We mentioned in the last episode how the explosion was so massive that it could be heard from over 50 miles away. Reporters and other people on the scene have stated that they heard the sound of additional explosions after the initial blast.
The seismology report from that day shows two distinct tremors, which people point to as evidence that there was more than one bomb.
Now, it's important to note that the official story is that the first explosion was the bomb, and the second sound that people think they heard was almost certainly just the sound of the building as it collapsed.
But, as seems to be the case with every aspect of this story, the appearance of a discrepancy has allowed for people to draw their own conclusions.
The multiple explosives theory was given credit by Samuel Cohen, a physicist who stated that he didn't believe it was possible for a single truck bomb to cause as much damage as it did.
Another big subject in this case is the science part of this. Again, you've got the falling elevator, but you also have a mountain, I'll use that word again, a mountain of experts that say an ammonium nitrate bomb did not do all of that damage by itself and couldn't have done that amount or pattern of damage.
There has long been a theory that a severed left leg found at the bombing site might belong to a potential 169th victim who was never identified. Or the leg could belong to a second bomber who was in the building, maybe even John Doe number 2 himself.
If the leg is actually that of a co-conspirator, why would they have been in the building when the bomb went off?
Well, if this story has told us anything, it's that McVeigh was prone to making the simplest of mistakes.
During his trial, McVeigh's defense tried to use the unclaimed left leg as evidence that he did not act alone. However, investigators found that it was much more likely the leg belonged to one of the many victims who lost limbs in the attack. It's unclear who the stray leg could belong to, if not one of the previously identified victims. No one who was in the building on the day of the attack is unaccounted for, and if this alleged co-conspirator supposedly died in the explosion, the rest of their body wasn't found among the wreckage.
Law enforcement was able to run DNA tests on the leg in 1997. However, the results of that test are private due to state laws on privacy of victims. This is also why no pictures of the leg are public, and why we don't even know the skin color of the leg. However, given reports that the leg was both burned and decomposed by the time it was found, a picture may not be helpful in determining who the leg belonged to.
While the leg is an interesting mystery, it's also more likely than not a part of someone who was killed or maimed in the blast. But because of the attention surrounding the mystery of the leg during the trial, the fact that we don't know for sure who the leg belongs to allows us to theorize.
If the leg belongs to a co-conspirator, that fits into a series of evidence suggesting the involvement of other white supremacists in the attack. In the months leading up to the attack, an ATF informant in a white supremacist group warned federal law enforcement about men discussing blowing up a federal building.
One of these men was Andreas Strassmeier, the security chief of Elohim City, a white supremacist compound in Oklahoma.
Strassmeier was a German who came to America in 1991 and joined Elohim City in 1992. He met McVeigh at a gun show in 1993, and the two reportedly formed a bond of mutual disgust over the government's actions during the Waco siege.
Now, there's no confirmation that McVeigh ever actually visited the compound at Elohim City, despite the fact that Strassmeier had invited him. McVeigh and Strassmeier would both later claim that McVeigh never went there.
From this point on, there are a number of claims from people who believe they saw McVeigh and Strassmeier together in the weeks leading up to the bombing.
After the bombing, an employee in the Murrah building named Jane Graham tried to tell the FBI that she had noticed a number of suspicious persons in and around the building in the weeks leading up to the attack. She would go on to identify one of these men as Andreas Strassmeier. this claim was never investigated until the next year, when Strassmayer had already left the United States to return to Germany.
Maybe by then they thought the case was closed.
The authorities had captured McVeigh and Nichols within days of the attack. The investigation into John Doe No. 2 was closed only a few months after the bombing, after no evidence of his existence turned up. It's possible they didn't see any way that Strassmayer could have realistically played a role.
Except for the fact that McVeigh called Elohim City 2 weeks before the bombing to speak with Strassmayer, apparently to arrange for a place for him to hide out after the bomb.
But Strassmayer wasn't available to take McVeigh's call, and apparently he never even knew that he had a message.
It's still hard to believe that law enforcement would knowingly overlook Strassmayer's potential involvement.
Especially considering one other detail. Carol Howe, a member of Elohim City, who reportedly dated Strassmayer while serving as an informant for the ATF, reported after the bombing that Strassmayer and McVeigh had made at least 3 trips to Oklahoma City, with one occurring in February 1995, 2 months before the bombing.
If this is true, could Strassmayer be John Doe number 2?
We'll put the evidence under a microscope in just a few minutes, but first, a quick break.
And now back to the story.
In February 1995, 2 months before the Oklahoma City bombing, an ATF informant reported that Timothy McVeigh took a trip to Oklahoma City with white supremacist leader Andreas Strassmayer.
This fact has fueled speculation that Strassmayer was involved in the attack, or even that he was the mysterious John Doe number 2 who was seen with McVeigh on the day of the bombing.
But mysteriously, law enforcement never investigated Strassmayer, despite the evidence pointing to his possible involvement.
For a time, there was a conspiracy that Strassmayer himself was an undercover agent of the FBI, the CIA, or another government agency. This would explain why he was never investigated.
There's almost no proof to support this, however. If Strassmayer had been working with the government as an undercover agent in Elohim City, why wouldn't he have warned his handlers about McVeigh's impending attack? A much simpler explanation is that Strassmayer simply spoke to the wrong white supremacist at the wrong time, and thus got his name roped into an attack he had nothing to do with.
It's still possible that the others in the Elohim City compound were helping McVeigh. There is a suspicion that Elohim City was involved in a series of bank robberies with the intent of funding attacks on the government, like McVeigh's bombing. The men behind these were known as the Midwest Bank Robbers. We know for sure that McVeigh and Nichols funded their plot by robbing Roger E. Moore, a gun collector that they both knew. Otherwise, it's unclear where they were getting their money during the months they were planning the bombing. Of particular note is that $20,000 that Nichols just had stashed away.
The Midwest Bank Robbers, also known as the Aryan Republican Army, are suspected of being involved with McVeigh primarily because one of the bank robbers, Michael Brescia, was Andreas Strassmayer's roommate for a short time. That's the only connection here.
That connection is pretty flimsy, unfortunately.
I think we like to believe that all white nationalist terrorists know each other, but the sad truth is, there's so many of them, there's no way for each individual cell to know exactly what the others are doing. Other than the roommate connection, there's nothing concrete, nothing that led to any significant action by law enforcement.
So, what would you give this one?
It's tricky. I'd go with 3 out of 10. If McVeigh and Nichols were being funded by a larger terrorist group, it's much more likely that the support was coming from a white nationalist organization than an Al-Qaeda cell. But at the same time, if there were more people involved, especially if those people lived as close to Oklahoma City as the Midwest bank robbers did, it just seems like someone else would have been arrested, or at least investigated.
Could the lack of investigation be because the government didn't want to risk mobilizing white supremacist groups into further action without being absolutely sure there was a deeper involvement?
Perhaps our next conspiracy theory can answer that question. Our last conspiracy theory is one that hangs over all the other possibilities related to the Oklahoma City bombing. It deals with what involvement, if any, the United States government had in either the bombing or in its investigation.
Government culpability is always one of the most common conspiracy theories whenever there is a terrorist attack. People want to believe a more significant power played a role in the chaos, and that it wasn't just the work of one madman.
The broadest conspiracy linking the government to the bombing suggests that President Bill Clinton's administration directly oversaw the planning of the bombing, and that McVeigh was nothing but a trigger man and a scapegoat.
People believe the president ordered an attack on his country's own citizens?
It's similar to the line of fringe thinking that believes President George W. Bush ordered the 9/11 attacks. The Oklahoma City bombing was the most significant terror attack of Clinton's presidency. In 1995, his administration was at the beginning of a series of scandals involving his sexual misconduct.
The theorists think Bill Clinton ordered the bombing to distract people from the scandals in his administration.
McVeigh himself claimed to have been recruited to a secret special forces group for the purpose of carrying out assassinations on American soil.
These claims were written in a letter that McVeigh wrote to his sister before the bombing. Though he doesn't claim to have actually assassinated anybody, he stated that during his training at Fort Bragg, he and some of the other trainees were informed they may be called on to smuggle drugs into the country or take part in government-sanctioned killings.
The problem is, the letter comes across as the ramblings of a sad, lonely man. He even writes in the letter that he, quote, wishes someone would understand him, unquote. It reads like more of a cry for help than the confession of a government assassin.
Terry Nichols did confirm that McVeigh was definitely part of such a special forces group.
The government, of course, denied it. And besides McVeigh's letter, there's no other proof to suggest that McVeigh ever ran with a military outfit outside of his basic training at Fort Bragg.
So the conspiracy that the government had a direct hand in the bombing would be easy to dismiss.
This conspiracy, that the government was behind everything, comes from the same people who perpetuated right-wing, anti-government theories that pushed McVeigh to carry out the bombing in the first place.
Right-wing conspiracy theorists lead a young man like McVeigh to blow up the Murrah Building, and then those same right-wing conspiracy theorists claim that McVeigh was an unwilling pawn in some sinister plot.
You can see how logic kind of gets left behind in this line of thinking. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't examine the government's role in the aftermath of the bombing. After all, there are far too many questions, nearly all of which fall under the main question. How did the government allow this to happen?
McVeigh allegedly executed prisoners during his time serving in the Gulf War, although that claim was never investigated and he was never charged. He also associated with white supremacist groups and regularly dealt in unlicensed, unregistered guns and gun parts. All of this would be enough to put him on a watch list, as was the case with Randall Weaver. And yet, McVeigh wasn't on the FBI's radar before the bombing.
Terry Nichols met his second wife through a mail-order bride service in the Philippines that was all but confirmed to be a prostitution ring. When she moved to America, she was pregnant with another man's child. That child suffocated to death in a plastic bag while Nichols was watching him. The death was ruled accidental, and after that incident, no one thought to keep a closer eye on Nichols.
McVeigh handed out pamphlets with the address of Lon Horiuchi, the sniper who had killed Vicki Weaver in the Ruby Ridge standoff. He did this with the specific hope that someone would kill him. Again, no one from law enforcement looked into McVeigh, even though his indirect threats against a federal agent constituted a felony.
McVeigh and Nichols purchased 3 barrels of nitromethane in 1994, which was way above the quantity that one would purchase for any normal use. Tim Chambers, the man who sold the nitromethane to them, immediately reported the men to the FBI. The FBI did not look into it, or if they did, they found no reason to keep tabs on McVeigh.
The getaway car that McVeigh used to leave Oklahoma City after the bombing was left abandoned for 3 days between the drop-off and the bombing. The car was left totally undisturbed during that time.
An ATF informant in Elohim City warned her handlers that there was talk among the people there of blowing up a federal building, and that Andreas Strassmeyer and McVeigh had traveled to Oklahoma City a number of times.
Again, law enforcement apparently declined to follow up on this. And when it later came to light that McVeigh had potentially been in contact with Strassmeyer, the FBI waited to question him until after he had left the country.
When McVeigh was arrested, less than 100 miles away from a deadly terror attack, carrying an unpermitted weapon and driving a car without a license plate, he was processed like business as usual. Only the tardiness of the judge scheduled to oversee McVeigh's case prevented him from being released before federal agents could get to him.
Despite the countless man-hours and pieces of evidence that went into the trials of McVeigh and Nichols, the government still can't account for how Nichols got that $20,000 he stashed away, or who John Doe number two is, if he even exists. On that point, the government hasn't even been able to determine if the man is real or not. You would hope he's not, because if John Doe number two is a missing link in this story, then a man who had a hand in the murder of 168 people has been walking free for 23 years.
We could honestly spend an entire episode just looking at the specific instances when the government could or should have looked into McVeigh.
I can't help but think of the irony. McVeigh dedicated his life to tearing down the government because he thinks they're encroaching on his freedoms, but in reality, the government's refusal to keep tabs on him was the only reason he was able to orchestrate the bombing in the first place.
The question now is, are all these oversights and missed opportunities part of a deeper conspiracy from within the government to allow Timothy McVeigh to carry out his bombing?
You almost want to believe that. At least then the entire case would be deliberate. There would be a reason behind what happened.
In reality, though, it seems like the true answer here is that it was the result of a series of simple mistakes. Consider the Ruby Ridge standoff and the Waco siege, the two events that pushed McVeigh over the edge and inspired him to carry out his own terrorist plot.
In both these incidents, U.S. law enforcement agents mishandled the situation, resulting in tragic casualties. In the case of Ruby Ridge, an FBI sniper shot and killed an innocent woman who was holding a child. In the Waco siege, law enforcement used military equipment and tactics against civilians, and a misguided raid that was supposed to end the siege resulted in the death of over 70 people.
The point we're making here is that law enforcement already had a track record of mishandling domestic terrorism cases by the time McVeigh decided he was going to blow up the Murrah building.
The bad PR over the handling of the Ruby Ridge standoff and the Waco siege actually likely helped McVeigh. After two very high-profile botched operations, the ATF and FBI were likely wary about provoking people like McVeigh. No one wanted to be responsible for the next Waco siege.
Conspiracy theories that blame the government for terrorist attacks often focus on the legislation that comes about as a response to those attacks. The conspiracy theory that George W. Bush had a hand in the September 11th attacks is based on the reasoning that Bush wanted a reason to invade Iraq. If that same type of reasoning holds true for this case, then if the government purposely allowed the Oklahoma bombing to happen, it was to justify legislation that limited the sale of bomb-making materials.
So, by that logic, McVeigh's mission to strike back at the government for limiting his right to possess guns might have been part of a plot to further prevent what U.S. citizens could or couldn't own?
Yes, but if we're being honest, this is hardly the most likely reason for all the discrepancies in this story. It's more likely that the failure to prevent the Oklahoma City bombing was due to a lack of communication between government agencies. McVeigh and Nichols traveled all over the country in the months before the bombing, barely leaving behind a paper trail. It's easy to see how they fell off the government's radar.
Well, you have a point. In the end, it might have just been bureaucracy, not conspiracy.
I'd give this conspiracy theory a 1 out of 10. I certainly don't think anyone in the government was knowingly trying to help McVeigh do what he did. All considered, the most likely explanation really is the official one. McVeigh and Nichols acted alone in carrying out the bombing.
Can the truth behind this massive tragedy really be so simple?
Well, consider McVeigh's own words. Quote, "Isn't it kind of scary that one man could wreak this kind of hell?" End quote.
It is indeed. All of these theories seem to come from a need to believe that this bombing wasn't just based on the whims of two men. And yet, that seems to be the most likely truth. Thanks for tuning in to Conspiracy Theories. If you want to hear more conspiracy theories or listen to any of Parcast's other podcasts, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory. And if you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review.
Tell us your favorite conspiracy theories on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and on Twitter at Parcast Network.
Join us next week for more conspiracy theories.
Until then, remember, the truth isn't always the best story.
And the official story isn't always the truth. Conspiracy Theories was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Conspiracy Theories is written by Colin McLaughlin and stars Molly Brandenburg and Carter Roy.